So the encouragement for tonight would be, if you're willing, to just see what it's like to connect with your emotional body throughout the evening. It's good for the purpose of what we call sensory clarity, or just developing more familiarity with our emotional body. Last week I talked about being present with what's pleasant and the practice of mudita, or sympathetic joy, appreciative joy. We could call it gratitude for ourselves and others. And tonight I wanted to talk about the topic of what I would call a familiar wound, meeting pain with compassion. Looking at the other end of this reality of our human lives. One of the key tenets of the Buddhist worldview is that life is equally beautiful and tragic, and that there's no escaping the ups and downs. This kind of harsh reality that I really felt like I could trust the Buddha's Dharma, his teaching, because of that, felt really resonant for me. That life was both beautiful at times and tragic at times. As the Chinese Buddha say, it's equally 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And that we're vulnerable to gain and loss and praise and blame and pleasure and pain. And that our freedom or liberation or awakening comes from how we relate to pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, beauty and tragedy, not on the conditions themselves. Because we always find ourselves in conditions that we like, conditions that we don't like, jobs that we like, relationships we like, jobs and relationships we don't like. You know, and that really, we have oftentimes this nearsighted, short-sighted view that our happiness is in those things, in those conditions. Right? That somewhere out there is the right formula for the conditions in life that's finally going to do it for me. You know, and it's this kind of constant, they call it samsara, or being born again and again into that same pattern. I noticed this because I bought a house recently, and always when there's a positive change or something exciting coming into my life, I can't help, and I think it's good, and we talked about this last week, the beauty of getting excited, right? But then there's this kind of unspoken message that maybe this is going to do it, right? This is going to be the thing that finally, when I have this settled, then I'll be happy. Or then I can rest. Or then, you know, the if-onlys. But really that our happiness is more found in the what we call the relational field, which is we're always in relationship with everything, with our internal world, to our own thoughts, emotions, physical feelings and sensations, in relationship with others, in relationship with our society and culture. Everything's about a relationship. And so mindfulness is about coming into the relational field. It's about tuning in, or attunement. Seeing how we are with ourselves and others, with pleasure and pain. And so I want to read, in talking about distress and stress, suffering, pain, this word dukkha, difficulty and challenge in life, I want to read a discourse that the Buddha offered. He said, "It's just like a person who is on an extended journey along a long road. Becoming sick halfway, she is exhausted and suffering extremely. She is alone and without a companion. The village behind is far away, and she has not yet reached the village ahead. Suppose a person comes and, standing to one side, sees that this traveler on an extended journey along a long road has become sick halfway, is exhausted and suffering extremely. She is alone and without a companion. The village behind is far away, and she has not yet reached the village ahead. This onlooker, this second person, thinks, if I were to get an attendant, emerge from being in the wilderness far away and reach a village or town, and were to be given excellent medicine and be fed with nourishing and delicious food, be well cared for, then in this way this person's sickness would certainly subside. So that person has an extremely compassionate, sympathetic, and kind thoughts in mind towards the sick person. So what the Buddha is doing, I love this passage, is he's helping us to understand what a compassionate view, right, would be in this situation with this sick person. That, and I like a lot of the painting of this picture. I think there's a lot to be said about what compassion is from the Buddhist perspective here. One is that they're seeing a difficult situation for what it is. Seeing what's difficult is difficult. An understanding or an empathy. And I like that in this scene, this onlooker comes up and sees this person is in the middle of a journey, right? There is a village behind them and a village ahead of them. And so part of this empathy is seeing where someone's coming from and where they're going, right? So part of, I think, what evokes compassion is being able to connect with someone's whole lived experience. And we often, I think, with people have a hard time accessing compassion when we have a hard time accessing their full story, where they've come from and where they're going, their intentions and motivations, the things that we can't see clearly so simply. So there's this extended journey that this person is aware of, and then there's also seeing the predicament or the challenge that someone's in, that this person's sick, they're stuck, they're exhausted. I think on a very simple level, we also overlook this. It's easy to hear, I know for me, if someone's ill or sick, and I know I have some general compassion because I know what that feels like. But it's hard in general, it's nothing to judge either, but it's hard in general to connect with what it feels like to be sick if I'm not sick, right? To see a person as exhausted and to see them in that predicament and to really feel into that, to have that empathy on that level. And then there's another aspect of this that I like where he's seeing, or this onlooker, whoever they are, is looking at how this person, this lady, is alone without a companion. Right? And so there's the seeing of the lack of support or the disconnection that this person's in, that they need help. They don't have anyone there to help them. They have no stability. They're between places. They don't have anyone along with them. Another thing that I like about this passage is that it shows that the act of compassion here is standing to one side. It says that in the language, meaning that this person's not involved in the sickness, right? I know it's a physical sickness here, but the person's not in the middle of the predicament with them. This person's looking on, right? So there's this kind of detached but engaged or observational perspective. And lastly, I think probably most importantly, are the Buddha saying at the very end of this how this person's desire to alleviate the suffering, the onlooker's desire to alleviate the suffering of the traveler, is the compassionate thought. That compassion, from a Buddhist perspective, is wishing a person to be free from suffering and affliction. Right, focusing on that we want to relieve, even if we can't do it, that's the compassionate thought or motivation, to relieve ourselves and others from suffering. So the emphasis historically, traditionally in the Buddhist discourses on compassion is the focus on relieving suffering, freedom from suffering. That's really what compassion is. Thoughts, but also through our actions, that we want to free ourselves and others from suffering. But the important, I think, an important basis or foundation for compassion is understanding or empathizing with the suffering itself. So there's kind of a prerequisite, I feel like, for compassion, which is we have to feel into the suffering of ourselves and others. We have to actually bring it into our awareness. Which is why we're called Against the Stream, and it's not necessarily a fun endeavor all the time, but being able to sit in the middle of our pain and to bring the flashlight of mindfulness to illuminate it. Right? To look into all the dark corners in the room that we don't ordinarily want to look into. The basis of empathy or feeling with, it arises from seeing suffering as suffering. Right? By sitting in the middle of our lives and bringing to mind all of the ways that we are experiencing challenge and discord and dissatisfaction, disconnection in our lives, we develop wisdom. This is why I like to use the phrase a familiar wound. Because one of the things about suffering, right, and when I say suffering, I mean the kind of unnecessary stress that we pile on top of the actual difficult situations in our life. Right? You guys know what I'm talking about. Like when something actually sucks and then we make it worse by beating ourselves up or judging ourselves or, you know, that type of stuff, it's this familiar wound, meaning we constantly find ourselves in this place. Right? We constantly find ourselves in this neurotic expectation and shame and self-criticism. Brené Brown calls this the inner hustler. She says the part of the mind that's always trying to prove and predict and compare and compete and outperform. It's like all of that added stress that usually comes out of our insecurities, that usually comes out of some deeper vulnerability. So in order to free ourselves from this added stress, we have to understand how it's caused, how it's propagated, how it continues. There's this word in Buddhism called papancha, and it means, it's a cool word, it's an onomatopoeia, where it sounds like what it is, and papancha means the spreading out. It's the tendency, I sometimes call it the drama queen mind or the drama king mind, right? It's the tendency that my mind has to pick up shit that's already bad and make it worse by making it about me and who I am and how I'm doing and evaluating and analyzing and comparing and criticizing, all that stuff, right? And so we have to really look at this. We have to sit down and watch the mind engage in this activity in order to uproot it. If we want to know the end of suffering, we have to know what causes it. We have to become intimate with it. It's a very odd thing, if you think about it, because naturally, we're going to want to move away from our pain and suffering and distress. But with Vipassana, insight meditation, we're really looking at our relationship to pain. We're seeing the stories that the mind tells about it, and we're seeing our often unconscious reactions that we habitually, reflexively act on to get rid of the pain first. The word for this distress, stress, the Buddha uses is dukkha, and if you've been coming for a while, the word dukkha is very familiar to you. As a Buddhist teacher, I named my dog Dukkha. It's a very common word. And what Dukkha is it's a lot of things. It means bumpiness or friction or stress or dissatisfaction. It's just the rub of life. Right? We don't really even have to overthink it. It's just that inherent in life is this up and down, this praise and blame, and all of this change. That there's some insecurity in life, and that the Buddha said that there's some wisdom to insecurity. There's some wisdom to acknowledging that. That our efforts often to find security or comfort or pleasure reactively, unconsciously, often causes more stress. And so to really meet our pain or our stress with compassion, we have to look at it. We have to understand it. And that helps us to build compassion, this understanding. So are we willing to be radically honest about the ways that we struggle? Are we willing to feel into the impact of our struggle for the purpose of seeing suffering. So that's an important distinction, is to feel into the impact. That means that we must feel, when I go around and I cause stress and suffering in my life, I have to feel that. I have to know that. And this goes against the stream of avoidance and denial, rationalization, minimization. Also, very often unlooked at, busyness, speed. Right? One of the greatest benefits of wisdom is slowing down. I call it the element of time and space. One of the best things about going on a meditation retreat or having a meditation practice is you give yourself time and you give yourself space. Two things that we are severely lacking in our culture, cultural conditioning. One of my favorite quotes, some of the folks that have been coming a while have heard me read this probably at least 30 times, is by Milan Kundera, a novelist, and he said that speed, the demon of speed, is often associated with forgetting and with avoidance, and slowness with memory and confronting. We move slowly when we want to listen to ourselves. We move slowly when we want to listen to others in the world around us. We move slowly when we want to accept ourselves. The rush of contemporary life overwhelms us in our ability to observe, to hear, to stop, and to wonder. Society in its speed wants to blow out the tiny flame of memory. So what do we forget that we need to remember? Speed makes us forget right here. Because I get caught up in all the things I've got to do later, all the things that I should have done, could have done, wish I would have done in the past, all of the fantasies and delusions of what it should be like, things that I'd rather be, places I'd rather be in, people I'd rather be with, all of the ways that we fall asleep into the stories of the mind. And so slowing down helps us to have this ability, as he says, to observe, to hear, to stop, and to wonder. To observe oftentimes means to observe what's difficult, the dukkha, the distress, and to wonder, to investigate. This word Dhamma Vichaya means investigation of things. To investigate or to look into what is causing this stress and how could I get free from it. So dukkha, this word, I think it is helpful to look at it in a couple ways. One is dukkha, the stress in our life, the pain in our life oftentimes comes from, we call it objective physical reality, which just basically means life conditions, death, disease, loss of things, jobs, changes in relationships, things that are really beyond our control, those things, right? Physical, objective things that come and go. And I feel like it's easier to have compassion for myself and others with these things. When someone's experienced sickness, I feel a little bit more ready and able to have a caring and, you know, a response that's wishing them to be free from that. When someone experiences death or loss. But the Buddha's teaching is really asking us to look much deeper into the subjective and interpretive realities, meaning our relationship to life's up and downs, how we're relating to and interpreting our experiences. Right? Chris talked about on Friday night, we had a guest teacher from Boston, he talked about the problem of views, right? And how we often get lost and caught up in how we interpret things. We misperceive or we limit ourselves to holding to fixed views. And part of mindfulness is looking into the mind to see how we perceive things. Do we just buy what the mind naturally throws up on the screen and tells us? Or do we stop and tell the mind, who says? How do you know? Right? When I'm criticizing myself, do I stop and I look at my mind and I say, you know what, dude? I don't know if that's true. challenging those self-made stories. So this is our subjective and interpretive reality. And it's what I talk about is the relational field, tending to how we relate to the changing conditions of our lives. I want to read a little bit more about, because I think it's important to understand this word dukkha and the wide variety of ways that it operates. This is Ajahn Sucitto. He's a monk, a Buddhist monk that I sat with about a year ago. He said, "Everyone knows the feeling of lack or loss or conflict in their lives. This is what the Buddha called dukkha, often translated as suffering, but covering a whole range of meanings and nuances. At times, we feel it as a sense of need or dissatisfaction that can vary from mild weariness to utter despair. This feeling can be triggered either by physical experience or mental views and impressions concerning ourselves and others. It's a feeling characterized by a sense that things are out of balance. Even if we are physically well and mentally skilled, we can feel disappointed that life isn't offering us enough, or that we're not making enough of it or doing enough, or that there's not enough time, space, or freedom. We can feel anxiety over the state of the planet and the environment. Our perceptions of the present and the future are not secure and problem-free. So that pulls on us emotionally. Then there's the sense of too much or feeling overwhelmed, not having enough space and time. In both cases, there's a continual sense of subtle or gross stress. Just reflect upon your activities and pursuits. Notice that they involve a constant effort to change or cope with what is disagreeable or to stimulate well-being. This striving to stimulate well-being is universal." So we want to come into, and really it's more of a practice of inquiry than answer. And this is what I like about meditation, is it's more about having questions than answers. Because the problem with answers is that that's where we get fixed. It's like, oh, I know. Right? The two things that I really am trying to work on myself is I know and yeah, but. Yeah, but. I know. Yeah, but. I know. Yeah, but. I know. Deflect, 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 deflect. What's underneath that? The unknown, the questions. More curiosity than answers. And this is really what I want to look at in assessing our own stress. How do we understand our stress for the purpose of developing compassion? How do we understand what's difficult in our lives for the purpose of having more compassion for ourselves? That's what I want to talk about. The first thing is we have to understand our relationship to our distress by assessing the conditions. This is the simple part. This is what I call the what is it. There are two parts to this assessing our stress. It's what is it and how is it. And the first, what is it, is about what's challenging in your life lately. Is it relationships, life changes, physical ailments, money, sex, work? Challenging doesn't have to, this is another thing we want to look at, it doesn't have to be a 10 on the scale. It doesn't have to be very bad. It doesn't have to be suffering. It can be mild irritation. So what is the rub in our life? What are the conditions? The work, the relationship, the stress. So that's what is it. And then how is it? This is the more important part. In psychotherapy, we talk a lot about, if you've ever heard of or know therapists, they talk a lot about processing. And processing is kind of going through the feelings and the emotions. It's more about your relationship, how you think and feel about what you're going through, not the thing itself. So the mind loves the thing itself. The mind loves to focus on the content. Well, if this person wouldn't do this, then I would be better, right? Or if I had a different job that paid me more, then I would be more comfortable, which is true. It's true. But the process is very important, which is the how is it affecting you and how are you relating to it? So understanding the emotional or affective impact, Right? How have these conditions, how have the things that have been challenging in your life lately that we maybe reflected on in the beginning, how have they been felt in your body? So being able to feel into the fear, to be able to feel into the underlying feeling, beyond the content, what's the physical impact? How does it feel to be with that challenging experience? This is the familiar wound. It's the thing that we often don't want to feel. I don't want to feel insecure and anxious. I don't want to feel not in control. I don't want to feel a lot of those things. And so I do all of these other things on top to get rid of those. And that's the dukkha. That's the sankhara dukkha, the emotional distress that I cause on top of the initial. So how is it means understanding our emotional or affective impact? How does it feel to be with that and in that relationship or in that job or with that financial insecurity or fear? What is that feeling actually? Can you connect to that? And can you start to feel into that in the moment? Bringing your awareness as that you're engaging with that person, place, or thing into the physical feeling of that. And then the other how is it is understanding the story you tell yourself about the pain. So this is real subtle. This is looking at how we identify with the thing. When identified with our pain, it can often feel invalidating to break our identification with the story that we tell ourselves. We hold on to the pain. We identify with it. We actually make the pain something that we cling to, right? By putting an I am in front of it. I am unlovable, or I am hopeless, or I am uncertain about my life, and what, you know, I'm not in the right profession. I'm not, we kind of fix ourselves to it. There's a lack of flexibility, and it's real hard and it's real subtle. Maybe some of us can feel into this. Maybe I'm articulating it in a weird way, but I think it's important to look into how do we identify with the story around our distress. Does that make sense? Like looking into what do I believe about myself in this story? Oftentimes when we start to look at the story around the pain, we feel these secondary emotions. We start to feel shame, right? We identify with it. We feel bad about, oh, I'm here again, right? You ever had that feeling? It's like, I can't believe I haven't gotten over this. Every relationship, I do the same thing, and then I find myself in this relationship. I'm doing the same thing that I did in the last relationship, and I'm just, it becomes an identity or a cloak that you wear. And so there is a reactive habit there. If I take the relationship as the example, there is a way, there's a pattern, right? There's a way that I find myself in the same relationship over and over, dealing with the same issues over and over. You guys know these things, right? These kind of like patterns. My relationship to money, or my relationship to a partner, or my relationship to places and things. Patterns. There is the reactive habit. Then there's the identification with it as I am this. The hopelessness that we feel. I'm stuck. Ajahn Sucitto says, for many of us, the urge to take on a spiritual practice arises through recognizing that whatever we do, wherever we go, this shadow of distress prevails. And it even follows us into the Buddhist practice itself. I've seen this myself, he's sharing a personal story. Being in a quiet place and living as a meditating monk, not having to worry about anything, I could feel irritated at a frog croaking. Why do there have to be frogs croaking? Why don't they just shut up and stop disturbing me? It's not a deliberate intended response. So this is the important part. It's not a deliberate and intended response. It's an instinctive reaction. It's automatic pattern. It's a reactive pattern. So because it's instinctive,
We feel that that's the way we are. And the possibility for change, even if we wish to change, seems remote. Habits and instincts define our identity, and that's where dukkha gnaws more deeply into our heart. So we start to identify with these patterns. We start to add all of this shame and this story of our worth and who we are and how we haven't, you know, done anything to dig ourselves out of the hole, that we're not ever going to get there, wherever there is, right? This kind of really subtle feeling of being stuck. Understanding the emotional reaction to the ups and downs in our life, understanding the emotional, automatic, reactive, pushing pain away, grasping after pleasure, automatic, instinctive, and understanding the story you tell yourself about who you are because you do that. So meeting pain, compassion, understanding pain helps us to encourage this wish. I wish to be free from doing this. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to suffer. I don't want you to suffer. From a Buddhist perspective, compassion is very simple. It's just concern for others to be relieved from suffering. All of this other piece I've been talking about is what we would call a contemplation of dukkha, if you've been coming a while. It's insight meditation. It's about looking into the distress. But compassion is just wanting and wishing for ourselves and others to be free from that distress. One of the things that compassion's not, I like defining things by things that they're not. So one of the things compassion is not, it's not sadness. And it's not dwelling in the misfortune of ourselves or others, which is pity, the near enemy of compassion. Dwelling in the misfortune, dwelling in the sadness, the affliction. There is that initial empathy when we feel and experience pain that you feel it with. That's what empathy means, to feel with. But that's not compassion. That's, I know that, I feel that, I'm with you in that. Oh, I actually take on some of that pain. Compassion is wishing for that to be gone. It's important to monitor and to stay out of dwelling in affliction for pain. I want to read just a little bit about that dwelling in pain. The cultivation of compassion itself finds its expression in the wish for the other to be free from suffering. In this way, the mind takes the vision of freedom from affliction as its object. So I'll read that again. It's a weird sentence. In this way, the mind, during meditation on compassion, takes the vision of freedom from affliction as its object. Such an object can generate a positive, at times even joyful state of mind, instead of resulting in sadness. It is vital insofar as a meditative development of compassion can only lead to deeper concentration if it is undertaken with a positive or even joyful mind. From a practical perspective, this means that one's cultivation of compassion needs to steer clear of sadness. This is not easy, since what causes the arising of compassion can naturally lead to being afflicted oneself by sadness. Does that make sense? So there's this important emphasis on tracking when we're practicing compassion, which we're going to do tonight as a meditation exercise, and holding that in mind, that we don't get overcome in the sadness or the affliction. That compassion, as in the traditional Buddhist discourses, should be encouraged as a practice, as a joyful state of mind, to imagine the freedom from suffering. It doesn't mean it should feel good. It means that as a mental state, it's light. It knows the freedom that's the possibility, or it wants to know the freedom that's the possibility. I think that that's very important, because I think we often get lost in the feeling of empathy, which is good. It's healthy. That's how we understand the suffering, to feel that with, and to investigate that, and to feel the effect of that. But when we start to get lost in the affliction, we're moving away from compassion. When we start to get overwhelmed in sadness, we start to move away from compassion. And as he says, it's easier said than done, right? Three processes to make this kind of simple, and then we'll do some meditation together, that I find helpful. One is recognize suffering is suffering. To bring into our awareness, to have accountability, friends, therapists, mentors, sangha members, people that we can talk to about the parts of our lives that we don't want to talk about. And to have a contemplative practice, meaning mindfulness, that we sit down regularly with ourselves and we look into the mind and we see what's going on in there. Not that it needs to be painful all the time. Life is pleasurable and painful and neutral most of the time, but that we don't shy away from, because we will automatically, if not bringing active awareness, from the more challenging and difficult parts of our lives. So the first part of this kind of three processes is recognizing suffering. This is what I call the I know you. I know you, becoming familiar. I know you. It's like the visitor that constantly comes in. Oh, I know you. I know you. Opening to that, this is the I feel you part. I know you. I feel you. And encouraging the mental state of compassion, which is, I care about you, and I wish for you to be free from this suffering. So it's like a moment-to-moment relationship you're having. You can do this in the moment when you're tripping about shit. I know you. Oh, I'm tripping. I feel you. Just sit with that for a second. What does it feel like to be tripping emotionally? There's probably a lot of fear and anxiety there. Can you feel it? I feel you. I feel you. I feel you. I care about you. Right? That starts to change. That's like such a radical shift. Instead of getting anxious and trying to push you away or figure you out or distract you and to feel better, it's instead, I know you, I feel you, I care about you. And I wish for you to be free from this suffering. I maybe don't know what that looks like or how to get there, but I wish that for you because I care about you. It moves the mind towards awakening. We have to look for the possibilities of getting ourselves unstuck. This is the hard work of the Dharma, looking for the possibilities of getting unstuck. Okay, I'm stuck. At some point, we've got to move. I know you. I've been here. I feel you. I care about you, and I wish for you to be free from this. What's that going to look like? What's that look like? Just sitting with that question. So I want to do a little bit of practice together, meditate for a little while, but maybe we'll take a short break for people to stretch their legs, 2-3 minutes if you need to run to the bathroom, and we'll come back and do some compassion meditation together.